We're going to be closing off the section or the series of Love and Pain of Shaul and David, Shaul's family and David, and we're going to really close it with a bigger perspective, standalone notion, and then we're going to charge forward into Perek Chof Aleph onwards in Sefer Shmuel Aleph. So just as a background, the question, the framework question for this evening, this is the aim. If this is in high school, the aim is always on the boards. The aim is simply two words, and that is, why love? Why love? Now, it's interesting, because what we've done in the last few parakim, when we went through Yod Ches, Yod Tes, and Chof, that's been this section, we've looked at this, and we've seen about the interesting and intricate relationships between those in Shaul's family, including himself, and David HaMelech. We've seen the complexity of Shaul's own relationship with David. We've seen the relationship of Merav, which is kind of apathetic to David, and then we have Michal, who deeply loves David, and Yonatan, who deeply loves David as well. And I just want to also make a footnote there. I know that sometimes you are likely to see articles today about David and Yonatan's relationship, and what does that really mean, and what's the Bible not really telling us, and so on. But in a mature fashion, just to put things above board, the Tanakh does not use descriptions of sexual intimacy when it comes to David and Yonatan. It talks about true love, and I feel it's a sad thing that today we can't talk about friendship without anybody sniggering or thinking about, you know, what else is going on behind the scenes. There was a time where people could have real relationships, real good relationships, and that's what the Torah is taught in Tanakh. Tanakh has very specific words when it comes to talk about intimate relationships, but this is not one of them. So there are, again, the Tanakh isn't itself not. The Tanakh is not being very specific over here, but the words it's using are not the words that we usually expect to see it. So I want to explore that relationship, the depth of the love of Yonatan and David as a relationship of friends. But I'd like to also explore it from the general overall picture, because here's the thing, is that ultimately, what hangs this whole story together, the plot along the line upon which everything hangs, is love, if you think about that. Everything else is somehow connected or hanging off of love. And if we think about the way that Michal's willing to save David against the bequest of her father, the fact that Yonatan is willing to spy for David and come back to David, and David trusts Yonatan to come to that field without being betrayed, right, those are self-jeopardizing actions, all in and of themselves, but they were done for somebody else altruistically because the one person cared so deeply for the other. That's how much the story hangs together. But it goes much deeper than that. If we think about this from the following perspective, what I'd like to do with you is the following: is to reverse backwards into Tanakh, Torah as a whole, to see this perspective. Here's how it goes. We're going to start with a small section in the Mora Nevuchim. The Mora Nevuchim is the Rambam's philosophical work. It's literally his guide to the perplexed, as he describes it. And this is the second section in chapter 48. He says the following. And this is a very, very powerful concept in general. And if we look at our own lives through this prism, it changes a lot of things that we see. He says, "Da, you should know, in Psalm 68, Shekol asibos hakrovois asher mehem nisrachesh mash nisrachesh. Any cause which any stimulus which causes ripples of effects in this world, ein hevdel bein shehayu oison asibos atzmiyos tiviyos or bechiriyos or mikrios. It doesn't make a difference whether those stimuli, those catalysts, were natural or they were humanly engineered, right? Because we can look at different things that happened because they happened or because somebody did something. It doesn't make a difference. Kol ze, all of this. That's a very big all. Everything is redirected to God. Hashem did it, Hashem commanded it. Now that's fascinating. So, you know, like, if I always wonder if we are to have Tanakh eyes and reread what we're experiencing in love through Tanakh's eyes, what would they say? What would they say about today? In those days, Hashem inspired, you know, the king of the Western powers to give the vision of Jerusalem being the capital of Israel, right? That's the way Tanakh would phrase it, you know? So if you think about that, meaning to say, what was it, the president's decision? Of course it was his decision. But how does Tanakh view it? is Hashem had his hand in that pie. And says the Rambam, everything is like that, the way it's from this perspective. And he gives three examples. These examples are very important for us. Omar b'parshas Rivka, v'tihi isha leven adonecha kasher dibir Hashem. So Lavan and Besuel, Besuel is no longer right now. Lavan and Mrs. Besuel say to Eliezer, yes, she can go marry the son of your master. And then at the end he says, Kasher Diber Hashem, like God spoke. Now it's interesting, do you think that was in the quotation marks? Not in the quotation marks, meaning was Lavan actually saying that? Or was Tanakh saying, as he was saying it, you know, the reverberations and echoes of the power of God is coming through his mouth, right? Not clear, but what the Rambam says is, nonetheless, all that decision-making process, that was God's plan. That was what he wanted. They made the decision, God made the decision. Now, the two other examples are really important for us. U'b'parshas David v'Yonatan, says the Rambam, in our very section, about David v'Yonatan, Omar, lech ki shlachecha Hashem. Go, because Hashem has sent you. And David speaks to Yonatan to go him on the mission to find out about Shaul. He says, because Hashem has sent you, which means to say that the machinations which are going on over here, of Yonatan spying and coming back to David and coming back with respect to David and not betraying David, is all God's plan. Another example, he says, Parshas Yosef, when it comes to Yosef, of course, it's a very timely topic. It says, Vayishlacheni Elokim lefneichem losum lochem sheris ba'aretz lachayos lochem pleita gedola. In Parshas Vayigash, in 2 weeks' time, Yosef says, don't worry, you didn't sell me into slavery. God sold me into slavery so I could finance and support the whole known world. Fantastic. So what the Rambam is doing over here is saying that sometimes we need to just zoom out. We need to zoom out. There's a book called Zoom. It's a book which is pictures within pictures. So you see a picture, and if you zoom out, you see the bigger picture of what's really going out in each of it. The whole book is just sort of expanding the sphere of consciousness. Rambam says, zoom out, realize that God is always holding the last handle, right? So you think you're pulling the lever, God's actually, you know, facilitating the rest of it. That's what he says. And the three examples are very fascinating to us. Let's focus on the last two examples just for a moment to really appreciate the depth of what the Rambam is saying. So as an example, so Yosef, in this week's parasha, Parshas Vayeshev, obviously, naturally, it was God's decision that the shear should have arrived right this week because we were preparing for Parshas Vayeshev. Yosef is sold into slavery, and it's a pretty ugly business, meaning, you know, you try to put yourselves in Yaakov, you know, shoes for those 22 years. He wasn't having a party, right? The brothers, in their regret for doing it, the pain they experienced. I mean, it was a pretty terrible time. Yosef wasn't either having a picnic down in Mitzrayim. It was a very difficult time for all of everybody else. At the end of this whole time, you can think of this. You know, you can think, you know, about Yosef sitting there in the corner, you know, grinding his teeth, you know, and, you know, pictures of his brothers with dartboards on. You know, like you can imagine what's going through his mind. And there's the moment he finally reveals himself, and then he says, you know, as the Rambam just says, don't worry. It wasn't, you know, look, take a look in source 69, the Bereshit Perek Mem Hey. Yosef says, don't get too upset that you sold me here. God sent me here to be the sustainer of the known world. Meaning, if it wasn't for me, who had spoken to Pharaoh and given this really exceptional interpretation and solution to his dreams, then we'd all be languishing in poverty. So it was a good thing, don't you think? Right person, right time, and you facilitated it. And you have to think to yourself, like, wow, Yosef, that's an incredibly selfless way of looking at your life. He had every right over here to hold a vendetta, at least a small one, right? He should have at least, you know, put them second in line or something. But no, he says, no, it's all Hashem. The fascinating thing over here is, if you want to deepen this, is that Yosef didn't even know the full truth. Meaning, Yosef is reinterpreted, he's zoomed out on his life, but he has not fully grasped the magnitude of what he's experiencing. So where do we see that? We see it in this week's parasha, in Parshas Vayeshev. The Torah tells us, Vayomer Loi, Yaakov says, Lech no re'ei, in Psalm 70, Es shlom achecha v'shlom ha'atzon, v'ashiveni davar. Go find out how your brothers are doing and return me the news. That was 22 years for that meeting to happen. V'yishlacheinu me'emek Chevron, he sent him from the valley of Chevron, v'yavar Shechema, and he went to Shechem. Geographical issue with this pasuk. For those who have been to Chevron recently, Hebron is not a valley. Hebron is a mountain, right? All the major area, all major settlements were near mountains, right? So this is not a valley. So why was he going from a valley? Says Rashi, Rashi comments and says, "Me'emek Chevron v'alo Chevron bahar." Surely Chevron is in a mountain. How does Rashi know this? Unfortunately, Rashi never got to go to the land of Israel. So Rashi knows it simply because Rashi's entire knowledge is framed with Psukim. So he says, "Shenema v'alo ba'negev v'avoad Chevron," that they ascended in the south up to Chevron. So Rashi knows geographically in his mind what Israel looks like, even though living in northern France. It's fascinating, just as a footnote later on, that there's many disputes between Rashi and the Ramban on interpreting certain things in the Torah. And at the end of the Ramban's life, the Ramban is exiled from Spain upon the publishing of his famous debate in Aragon. And he arrives in Israel and he says he reforms some of his opinions based on what he actually sees there, because he never had the opportunity. He couldn't just hop on a plane and go. This was, and so his whole worldview shifted. But anyway, so Rashi sees that he's leaving, he lives in a valley. He lives on a mountain, so how could it be that he's going from a valley? The reason why Yosef was leaving Chevron was he was leaving the advice or the plot of the depth of Chevron. Who lives in the depth of Chevron? Well, at this point in time, Avram lives in the depth of Chevron. Avram is buried under Chevron. Because Avram was promised by the covenant between the parts, the Bris Ben Abasarim, that your children are going to be strangers in a foreign land. So there's Yosef, who's saying, "Yes, Dad." And there's Yaakov saying, "Go find their peace." And it's all a very nice and neat picture at this point in time. And it gets worse, and Yosef expands the scope of this picture. But they both don't realize that there's a much bigger machinations going over here. The cogs are turning in a much deeper machine, coming down from the depth of the Bris Ben Abasarim of Avram. Do you see what's happening over here? Meaning, we're called increasing perspectives on what's really going on in life. This is what Yosef is experiencing over here. That, I think, is what the Rambam means when he says in Mor Nevuchim that we can say that everything that happens, everything with a capital E emboldened, is ultimately from God. That's this example. But now, let's now shift backwards into our story. Okay, let's try to come back here. By the way, just not going to quote it inside, but in this particular episode, the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah says that God could have got Yaakov Avinu down to Mitzrayim in many ways. There was a promise to Avram Avinu that your children are going to be a ger be'eretz lo lohem. They're going to be these strangers. So how are you going to get them to there? So Hashem has many ways. So the Medrash says he could have had Avram imprisoned and taken down in chains. There's many ways that God could make these things kind of things work out. But instead God pulled him, the Medrash uses the word, avosois shel ahava, the ropes of love. Why did Yaakov eventually go down to Mitzrayim? Because of the love of his son. Why else would he go down to Mitzrayim? Meaning Hashem orchestrated. There was this greater picture unfolding right now as Yosef is experiencing this micro drama. Certainly wasn't micro from his perspective, but we'll call it world history. This micro drama is now unfolding a macro picture, which is happening over here. And that's how, this sort of resonates with us as well, is it's not through pain, but pain which is ultimately connected deeper to love, which is pulling Yaakov Avinu down to Mitzrayim, which is just frames the picture. So now, coming back to our place, we need to ask the question is, why love? Why is love the tool of choice, the vehicle of choice, which now connects Yonatan, David, Shaul, and Michal? Remember, if Michal didn't love David, he'd still be in his bedroom when the soldiers came. If Yonatan didn't love David, then he may have stepped into the wrong Sa'uda and been killed by Shaul. Right? Love has protected David HaMelech. Why is it that that's the underlying meridian in this story? So it goes back earlier. Dina, frown. Okay. Well. I'll hold on that. Now I'm getting worried. Okay. Well, let's develop this theme and tell me what you think about this. So what I want to do is I want to just develop the notion again. We're now delving into the depths of Rabbi Yehoshua Bachrach, one of the Tanakh geniuses. It's such a pleasure to read from him. Because this particular essay is a 30-page essay, and he gets so involved that he goes on tangents upon tangents upon tangents on tangents. Because it's just everything is holistic. Everything slots together. So suddenly you're reading about David and Yonatan. And then suddenly it's all about Bereishis. And then it's all Rachel and Leah. And then it's all Yud and Yos. And everything, it's like a speed train of experience. And so we're not going to do all of that. But I want to take some of the the ideas to try to get a sort of coherent notion of where we're going and where this is framed, because it's quite remarkable. So this is my own summary of some of the points with a few additions. Here's how we're going to go. We're going to actually reverse to the starting point of this, because of course we know that that Yonatan and David are from different tribes, they're from Binyamin and from Yehuda. So we're going to reverse backwards to where this really started. It actually started. It started at numerous points. We can point to some. Some would say, you know, already when Yaakov Avinu and Parshas Vayishlach is bringing his family back, and what he does is when he's meeting Esav, you know, he puts certain family members before other certain family members. So Leah and her children came in front of Rachel, which says something, right? We already know, if we went back to Vayetze, that there was a triage of love between Yaakov and Leah and Rachel. And a lot of what we're seeing now in Tanakh is really expression of a lot of what we'll call the gene. Of what's being formatted for the later Shvatim and nation. So let's take a look at one of these. This is the Gemara, which is to be found in Baba Basra and in Megillah. The Gemara says something which is a very, very powerful notion. It's to be found on the top of page. Let's just see where it is. This is the page 20, it's source 73. The Gemara says the following: Amar Rabbi Lazar. Rabbi Lazar would say, "My dechsev lo yigra mitzadik eino ves melachim lakisei." What does it mean that a righteous person will never lose out for what they saw? So the Gemara says, "Beschar tznius shahasa baba Rachel zoch soviyatz v'menu shol." The reason why Rachel merited to the first king of all of Israel, Shaul HaMelech, was because of her tznius. How do you translate the word tznius? Literally, modesty. Right. That's the way we usually translate it. But the strange thing is, let's hold that word in play, because that might not be the most apt description of what we're about to hear. What was this modesty? When Yaakov arrives at the well, right? The well seems to be the local meeting place for young men and women. So when he first meets her, he says to her, he tells her that he is the father or the brother of her father. Achi of Yahu. Yes. That her father's brother is... One second. Achi Aviyahu, yes. His mother, Rivka, is the sister of Lavan, her father. Good. Okay, complicated. that's exactly why we're having trouble. He isn't really the father of her, or the brother of her father, Valoi Ben Achos Aviyahu. He is the son of the wife, of the daughter of his father, of the sister of his father. Elo, Amala, Minsa Belit. He says to her, you know, let's get married. Amra lai, Cain, she says, absolutely. That was it, by the way, that was it. That was the whole story should have finished right then. Right, but, miu avi ramohu velo yichol esle. She says, my father is a trickster. You're not going to get round him. Amra lai, ira maihu achiv ana v'ramos. She says, don't worry, I know how to deal with these kind of folks. Amra lai, umi shori le tzadik le seguya v'ramos. She says, but I thought you were a tzadik. Right, do you do such things? So he says, Amala, I have to sometimes, im navar titabar v'im yikesh titapol. When you deal with crooked people, you sometimes have to act crookedly. Amala, umay remi yusa. So he says, well, tell me, you give me an insider's version. What do you think he's going to do? So Amala, yesh li achos gedola mimeni v'lo yidnene lehinase lefonel. So I have an older sister. I know exactly what's going to happen. He's going to marry my older sister to you. So they made the secret sign between the two of them. So they now are, this is their insurance policy against Lavan's trickery. Because should the wrong sister come to the chuppah, as opposed to just looking at through the veil, they have the set of simanim. So the Gemara concludes. Ukosheras Rachel shemachnisin loy leleya, Amra achshav. When she sees Leah being pulled in, she says, well, my sister's going to be so embarrassed in this situation. She's going to have to hand them over to Leah. Now, there's a lot of things we need to think about in this Gemara. First of all, the word tznios is strange. Tznios literally means modesty. How would you categorize what really is going on over here? This is what? Oh, it is too hard. So she is hiding. But what would the primary act be here? One of compassion, maybe, of sensitivity, right? So there's other words we might have used over here to describe her actions, which is interesting. That's number one. But number two is you see something interesting. If you just sometimes we read this and we hear about this and we just pass on, but we have to put ourselves in their shoes for a moment. You know that Yaakov arrived and he didn't marry Rachel for 7 years, right? So this was 7 years. And although the Torah tells us that they were Yamim Achadim, Ba'av Oso, they were very fast because he loved her so much. So to him it was this very fast period of time before he could marry the Rachel he thought about. If you think about it from the other perspective, not so simple. Right here in this house are two sisters. Here's Rachel and Leah. Who's the one who's probably, you know, preparing his dinner when he comes back from the field working? It's probably Rachel, right? And Rachel takes those Shabbos afternoon walks with him. You know, and the two of them are really getting to know each other, and they're building a relationship over here. They're not married yet. but there's no mother in the picture. The Midrash tells us that the mother is no longer in the picture, which is why Rachel, when she originally comes from the well, she tells her father, you know, about this stranger that she met. Which is interesting. The mother's not, so there's no we'll call matriarch in this family. It's just the two of them, and who they're going to talk to about, you know, issues that are going on are each other. This is the relationship they have, and the Midrash describes that Leah, you know, there were two children to this side of the family, and there were two children to that side of the family. There was Yaakov and Esav, and there was Leah and Rachel. Right. So there was, you know, as things go very simply, you know, without doing too many complicated shidduch resumes, you know, the older to the older and the younger to the younger. So Esav would be for Leah, and Yaakov would be, and Rachel would be for Yaakov. That would be the way that it was supposed to work out. So the Midrash describes how Leah would go out to the Prashas Drachim, to the crossroads, which of course is the best place to gather information because all the travelers are going through that direction. And Leah would ask, "Tell me about Esav." And the longer she asked, the more depressed she got, right? Because it didn't sound like he was going in the exact track of the guy she had on her resume. And so she cried and cried and cried. And that was why Ene Leah Rakos, that the eyes of Leah were soft from crying. So imagine this, like imagine for 7 years this goes on. And here's Rachel, you know, with, you know, this beautiful dream on the horizon, and there's Leah crying in her pillow every night. That's what she's dealing with, right? But she knows, like, now let's put turn the table. So if she's going to do this, what's going to end up happening? I mean, what are the repercussions for giving Leah the signs? What was that? So repercussion number one is she may have to end up marrying Esav, right? That's not just sacrificing her dreams, that's also jeopardizing anything she may have left. That's repercussion number one she has to deal with. But another repercussion, basic trust repercussion, is maybe Yaakov's going to say, wait a second, I thought we were on the same side. You're complicit with your father's deceit? That's a goodbye, right? Meaning to say everything is on the line, but still you can see the emotional turmoil that Rachel's in over here. The Gemara says she gave it to her. The reason why many of the Mepharshim debate what of this Gemara are, why is it, Chaim Shulevitz has a whole beautiful piece in this, why is it the tznius of Rachel? Is because she did it in a way that Leah didn't feel as if she was being patronized. She did it in such a way that it was so subtle, it was so undercover that Leah didn't even feel as if there was something special about it. She said, you know, she gave it over in a way, she sublimated herself to a degree that Leah did not feel even as if she was taking that from her. Can you imagine that? It's, I mean, just a remarkable sacrifice that Rachel puts on the line. And this is why, says the Gemara, why she had the schus of having the first king before anybody else, any other tribe. It was a king from her legacy. And it's interesting. That doesn't just mean to say that, you know, she's got a lot of stars in the star chart. That means to say something about Shaul is expressing that same attitude. Just to be clear. Meaning Shaul had something of that in him as well, which led him to become the king. So let's develop this a little further. This was the incredible selflessness of Rachel herself. As an aside, just as an interesting aside, just, you know, that danger that she thought she might jeopardize her relationship with Yaakov. Later on, the Kedushas Levi, Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berditchov, says in his Pirush on the Torah, a remarkable thing. Why does it say, Vayehav Yaakov es Rachel mileah? Why does it say that Yaakov loved Rachel than Leah? So sometimes people think, oh, favoritism. So what the religious lady says is that he loved Rachel even more because of what she did for Leah. Mm-hmm. That's the way he reads it. Meaning, as opposed to jeopardizing the relationship, actually enhanced the relationship because he realized the sacrifice she had made for her sister. So just as an aside, she didn't lose that piece of it. Nonetheless, that's on the one side. That's Rachel going towards Leah. That's sort of the amount that she cares about in that direction. What about the other direction? So there's a remarkable medrash. I never saw this before. The medrash Tanchuma on Parshas Tanchuma HaKadum says on Parshas Vayetze. Take a look at this. It's quoting a pasuk in Tehillim. This is to be found in source 74. The medrash says, "Amar Rachel, Pada b'Shalom Nafshi, redeem in peace my soul. Bizchus man nosan li HaKadosh Baruch Hu banim." Why was it that I had so many that I actually had children after 14 years of not having children? Because many were with me. What does that mean? That's it was because Yaakov and Leah prayed for me. That's why I had children. That's why Hashem prayed for Rachel. To deepen that, what really actually happened over here is that the when Leah was pregnant with her seventh. So we assume that all the Imahos knew that there were going to be 12 tribes. Okay, so that's there's this knowledge, this foreknowledge. Yaakov even knew this because of those 12 rocks. There's this notion that they know what's going to be the end, which means to say that the equal distribution is going to be, should be, 3, 3, 3, 3, right? Leah has 6. Now the problem is that if she's pregnant with the 7th, that means to say, and each of the maidservants, Bila and Zilpah, have 2 each, that means to say 6 and 4 is 10. If she has a seventh boy, that means Rachel is going to end up having less than even Bilhah and Zilpah if she has a shevet. So it says that's what the Midrash describes, that is why Leah prayed and she had Dina. Dina was the product of her remembering the zchus of what Rachel did for her, and because she prayed for Dina, that's what triggered the reaction of Rachel having her own child. Now, how does that work? It's interesting. What Rachel Shulevitz explains, the spiritual mechanics of this is that when we do something good for somebody else, that accrues a great amount of zchus. We care about somebody, we greet somebody, we help somebody at a time of difficulty, that accrues a great amount of zchus. But when we do something for somebody else and that other person learns from that and reproduces that because one taught them that, then one's own zchus exponentially grows. Because one hasn't just invested, one has invested and now planted the seeds for further investment. When Rachel did a good thing for Leah, that was a huge amount of zchus. But when Leah turns around and remembers that and does the equally, in a certain sense, the equally self-negating action on behalf of her sister, that now turns the whole sluice gate shifts. Everything moves open, and Rachel has, in terms of the spiritual flow, is now able to reconnect. That's what the Midrashim is saying over here. Now, which means to say, if you think about this, the children, the birth of these children, and these 12 boys and Dina are all part of they're a product ultimately. Each person's personal redemption was as a function of the other person's sacrifice. That's what ultimately we're getting to. The reason why Leah is married to Yaakov is because of Rachel's sacrifice. The reason why Rachel has children is because of Leah's sacrifice. That's how they came into being. Which means to say that the only way this can really work is if there's a sense of sacrifice, a sense of giving, altruistic, selfless giving in both directions, which allows this unit of a family to exist. That's the basic bedrock of where we're coming from. And in fact, when Rachel finally does have a child and she has her first child, she calls his name Yosef, which is a strange name for a child. There's 2 reasons. The second reason is, as she says in the pasuk, "Vatikra shmo Yosef elemor Yosef Hashem li bin ben acher, Hashem should give me another child." The Midrash in Bereshit Rabbah says, "Amar Rabbi Pinchas mitfilas shel Rachel loichalak shevet Yehuda binyamin im aseres hashvatim." The Midrash makes an enigmatic comment that because of Rachel's prayer, her prayer really dug to the depth that the child that she would have would in fact be one which is inextricably linked to Yehuda. Interestingly enough, her Binyamin is going to be inextricably linked to Yehuda. And we know that in terms of the inheritance, the southern kingdom was always made up of the 2 tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin, where they shared the base of English in the lower regions. The other 10 Shvatim were the northern and eastern regions. Okay, so there's somehow a connection between her last child, which is built on the same edifice of sacrifice. Now, let's move that further. So we, in a certain sense, again, we're talking really broad strokes. There's many more details and subtleties to this. There's much more to this, but on a basic level, there's this notion of what we'll call dual sacrifice or dual real love of what is going on. If you would forgive me for quoting Frozen, but the notion of there has to be some sort of twist at the end. The twist was that the love, the true love, is the love of sisters. If you think about that, that's the twist of the crux of the plot. And over here, the crux of the plot is that true love of sisters is what facilitated the creation of the Shiftei Kov, these tribes, because they were able to do this for each other. That's kind of where we're getting from. Lahavdil, just to give a sense of how difficult that can be. Now we translate to the next generation, and that brings us back. Okay, because this is the foundation work. Now we need to translate it generations afterwards. So in 2 weeks, Parasha Yehuda is standing in front of Yosef. This is the last moment over here. The brothers have gone through the bushes and back. Trying to please this viceroy, this really punitive viceroy of Egypt, who doesn't seem to give them a break and is laying false charges upon them time and time again, seems to really be going from highs to lows, within the span of minutes. And now he comes in front of him, and Yehuda says, he makes his very eloquent and emotional speech. And here it is. Something in the speech is what turns Yosef around, and Yosef reveals himself now at this moment. So what is it in his speech that does that? So let's take a look at what he says. Here's Yehuda. In the sources, Bereshis 41, source 76. He says the following. V'anomer lo nuchal lo redes im yesh achino akatan itonu v'yoradnu ki lo nuchal liros p'nei ha'ishu achino akatan enenu itonu. So we said to our father Jacob, we can't go down to Egypt if we don't bring our youngest brother. He's not going to accept us. V'ayomer avdecho v'yelenu. And your servant, our father, Yaakov, says to us, Atem yedatem ki shnai me'ol do li'ishti. Two were born to my wife. V'ayotza echad me'iti v'omar ach torov torov v'lor yisiv adhena. One left. And I said he was probably killed, and I haven't seen him since. Ulakachtem gam ezemim ponai v'karoa oson. And you're going to take this last one, my Binyamin, and something happens to him. V'oradtem esevasi b'ra'ah sheol. You're going to bring down my old age to Sheol, to the netherworld, in pain. V'atok avoy yaladocho aviv anar enenu iton v'nafshoi k'shur b'nafshoi. And now I'm bringing, I have this Binyamin, and his soul's connected to my father. I return to my father, and there's no boy, he will die. You're going to kill my father in sorrow, in grieving. Because your servant, meaning me, I, Yehuda, took responsibility. I would have sinned to my father all of days. And now let me stay in the stead of Binyamin, and he will go back to my father. What is it then that shifted Yosef to make his big reveal right now? No point earlier. What was it in Yehuda's words? Which this is one passage before. Yosef Yosef could not hold back any revealed himself. What was it? Well, so it's interesting. So the most overt thing is his sacrifice. Meaning to say, this is the most incredible sacrifice over here. Here, we never want to measure one life against another. But Yehuda could think, what a productive and successful life I have ahead of me, right? And look at the accomplishments and the experiences that I have. Why should I sacrifice me for him? Right, but nonetheless, Yehuda is willing to do that. Right, his whole life, he's going to end up, scratching numbers onto Egyptian jail cell from the inside. That's going to be his life. Why? Because his father. That sacrifice is so immense. But if you think about it as well, the Ramban points this out. Look at the way he describes the conversation with his father. He describes, he's quoting his father in Pasuk Chof Zion in 27. He says, "Vayomar dechavi elenu." Our father said, Atem yadatem, you should know, ki shnaim yod ola ishti, two, my wife bore for me. Who's his wife? Rachel. Do you notice that? Here is Yehuda, the son, the prime son of Leah, quoting his father as saying, my wife had two children. What about the rest? They have chopped liver. What happened to them? Right, you see what's happening over here? Yehuda, in his speech, has acquiesced, in a sense, to understanding that, yes, to his father, Rachel was very, very, very dear. And he would call her my wife, not his mother. That's what he's saying in his speech, says the Ramban. It's not just the actual sacrifice of a place. It's the sacrifice of self, of his standing, which is occurring, which is what Yosef hears in the speech over here as well. Meaning to say, over here is the self-sublimation of his side of the family to the degree that he's able to even say, get those words out of his mouth. That's shocking, but that's how far it goes. Now, the reason why this is so important is because not only is he doing the same, we're called Rachel-esque or Leah-esque action, right, which is moving in the opposite direction to save the other. And that's what Yosef was waiting for. Are you going to sell your other side of the family into slavery when it's too difficult? Or are you going to now take the slavery to save the other side, right? That's exactly the opposite of what Yosef was experiencing. Are you going to do that? But it goes further. Because this is the seeds of Shmuel Aleph. This is where it happens. Take a look at this Medrash. This Medrash is remarkable. This Medrash is now in the Alkit Shimoni in Shmuel Aleph. It says the following. Here we go. Let's see where it starts. Omar Rav Yehuda Bar Simon. Let's see where here we are. This is in source 17. The Yalkut Shimoni. Rav Yehuda Bar Simon would say, Lomud oiso shevet lios orev elu leelu shenemar onochi ervenu. Yehuda has known to be in the guarantor for which tribe? For Binyamin. As we know, Yehuda made the sacrifice on the steps of the royal palace in Vayigash. Omar Yishai el David. Yishai says to David, his son, Hare hasha shetelech v'takayim oso ha'arvus shel Yehuda zekeinecho. Now is the time that you're going to put your money where your mouth is. She'arev es binyamin miyad aviv. That he said he was going to do this. Anochi arvenu leich v'otzeo samin arvusoi. Take Yehuda out of the guarantee that he gave. Ma'aso David, what did David do? Holach v'harag es Goliath. He went to kill Goliath. What is he saying? What is this Midrash ultimately saying? Why was killing Goliath saving Binyamin? Why was killing Goliath saving Binyamin? Who's the king? The king is Shaul. Who was Goliath asking for a duel with? Right, he was asking for the king, who couldn't come out, who was, for whatever reason, he was afraid, he was worried about the consequences, he was worried about letting his people down, whatever it was. Shaul couldn't and wouldn't go out there. There's this dark cloud hanging above Shaul because nobody can do this. Says Yishai, David, now's the time. Meaning to say, David is, in a certain sense, replicating that same action that Yehuda said, but Yehuda didn't have to carry out. Now he's putting himself in harm's way to save Shaul HaMelech. Now, if we're coming back to the Rambam, the machinations of history are moving, right? Yehuda said something, he meant something. Yishai is saying, do it. Let's make it happen now. God is moving history in your favor, David. Now's the moment. He goes out in the garb. He puts on the war garb of Shaul to go in front of the train so that it doesn't hit Shaul HaMelech. That's what he does. This is now coming full circle. Immediately after this, what happens? This is David's sacrifice, because, meaning, David HaMelech didn't even have a sword, right? As he's walking out towards his giants. Let's face it, right? This was a terrifying sacrifice. He believed in what he was doing, but nonetheless, the odds were highly stacked against him, despite what Malcolm Gladwell said, right? We discussed that a little while back. He gets onto the battlefield. He kills Goliath. It's an incredible victory. What happens immediately after that battle is the sacrifice moves backwards in the other direction. Take a look at, what was that? Shaul immediately starts saying, "Whoa, whose son is he? He knows something's happening." So Shaul knows something's dangerous is going on. So Shaul asks about that. Immediately following that exact episode is the following pasuk in Perek Yuches, which we saw. Take a look in the next source. Vayikach halosol daber al Shaul v'nefesh Yonatan nikshara v'nefesh David v'yaveu ki Yonatan kanav shoy. We're told about the love of Yonatan for David, right? You see what's happening over here? Something's happened. Yonatan also watched this boy go out onto the battlefield. Yonatan also watched this person who took the place of his father to save his father's position and fight that war. And he is totally, completely in awe and endeared to this David over here. But not only is he endeared to him, it's more than that. We're going to get to him, God willing, in a few brachim in Perek Chof Gimel's time. This is how far it goes. Yonatan says the following. ויקום יונתן בן שאול וילך אל דוד חורשה ויחזק את ידו באלוקים ויאמר אליו אל תירא כי לא תנצח יד שאול אבי. He says to, this is a, you know, incognito, so that Shaul doesn't realize. Yonatan says to David, don't worry, my father's not going to get you. I know you're going to rule over Israel. I will be your mishneh. I will be your courtier. That's explicit as it goes. What is Yonatan doing? Yonatan is essentially taking off his gauntlet or his royal crown, and he's giving it to David. The only way that David can enter as a king is if the children of Shaul put down their crowns and swords. That's the only way it can happen. And by the way, it doesn't. After Shaul dies, the Avner props up the king called Ish-bosheth. He props up one of the children of Shaul to try to recreate that kingdom, which takes 7 years for David to actually enter into real kingship. Because of that, what Yonatan is saying is, I'm removing that hurdle. I'm going to be your courtier so the whole world will know. It's not going to be two Israels. It's not going to be north-south. It's not going to be Binyamin Yehuda. It's going to be Israel, and you're going to be the king, and I'm your courtier. You see what's happening over here? David, on the one hand, capitalizing on Yehuda's sacrifice for Binyamin, and Binyamin responding back saying, you know what, I understand how this works, and the only way it works is together. How do we look at reality? Is reality a zero-sum game? Is the only way to win if one person wins? That's the way most of the world looks at it. That's the way most of the world looks at it. You know, the first settlement in America, which was the first colonial settlement in America, Columbus left the first armada to set up a camp and to settle down as the outpost for Spain, for Castile to lay its claim to the newfound land, and they all killed each other. There was too much gold and too many slaves at stake for anybody to be able to say that we could work. It was a zero sum game. They all killed each other. You know, that's the way the world generally works. Rabbi Dessler talks about in Kuntras HaChesed how he watched an episode where people showed him a video where there were a pack of wolves. They were trying to, in the winter, they were all starved and they were trying to get a particular prey. They captured the prey, but they all started fighting each other to get the prey. And ultimately, they started biting each other, attacking each other to the point that by the end of this battle, there were about, you know, a dozen wolves lying, bleeding on the ground, while two of the more powerful ones were getting away, and then the wounded ones came and attacked them again. There was only one wolf in that view of reality who could actually succeed in getting the food. The rest of them died trying, or almost died trying. That's the way the world generally works. What's happening over here is the most remarkable self-sacrifice, because it isn't a zero-sum game. Kingship and unity doesn't work because one person wins. That's what David and Yonatan are displaying over here. If we want to take it to its full ends, it comes back to a fascinating end over here. It is interesting, by the way, that there is a sefer written by Rav Dov Rosen called Ohalei Shem. He points out that the word David in Tanakh appears 1,074 times, and of them, 285 of them have a yud. Dalad, vav, yud, dalad. So there's an extra yud there. It doesn't change the sound, but it's just the extra. It's called a male. His name is full. And if you look in the names of Yonatan, as we noticed, has one spelling, which is Yonatan, and another spelling, which is Yehonatan. We talked about how Yehonatan's name changed at the point where he sublimated himself to David. That was his expression of self. But if you take those letters, the yud and the hey, that's actually the name of Hashem. In the same way, you know that the word ish and isha, if you take the extra, the ish, right, there's the yud and the hey. The union of David and Yonatan, in a certain sense, was this union in which God resided, because God can only reside when there's facilitation happening and self-sacrificing on both sides to create the Malchus Yisrael, which is what is happening. Which is why, when we finally get to David HaMelech's painful eulogy of Yonatan, when Yonatan is later killed at the hands of the Philistines, he says the following, and this is about his dear friend. These are the words he says in eulogizing him. This is towards the end. The source is 80 in Shmuel Beis. It says, "Tzar li alecha achi Yonatan, Yehonatan. I am pained of you, my brother Yonatan. Na'amt li ma'od. You are very pleasant to me. Nifla'aso avoscha li me'avas noshim. Your love was more to me than the love of women," meaning to say a marital union. Now, this is where people sometimes say, "Whoa, wait a second, what are you talking about here?" That's not what it means. What the Midrash says and what is capitalized on the later Mefarshim is the following. Let's actually read it inside just so to appreciate the power of this. This is the last source. This is the Rama Mipanu, who lived about 800 years ago. He says the following. Pirush Yad Yehuda, V'chein b'mishpat ha-melech chofetz elyon, she'ehe Yonatan, shehu mi-binyamin ha-tza'ir, konena kisei l'malchum al-chus l'david. Hashem wanted it to be that Binyamin would be the preparer of the dynasty for Yehuda. He would be the prerequisite for getting Yehuda into place. V'zeo niflasa avascholi. That's what David means when he eulogizes him. He says it is miraculous. It is wondrous. Your love for me is wondrous, meaning to say it is so not natural that you, as the scion of Binyamin, should sacrifice yourself for the scion of David to create this unity. And that's what he says. Why? What's the reason? Misibas, from the reason. Avas noshim, the love of women. What does that mean? Imosenu. What he means is, it's the love that the sisters, our matriarchs, had. That's how you could do it. Asher gam heim kenosu. They themselves did the same. Meaning, this didn't just happen out of nowhere. This is built on the foundations of the fact that Rachel and they were able to be able to come through this together for each other, that you, Yonatan, were able to do the most incomprehensible, uninstinctual action, which is to offer yourself as the courtier for the king, so we should have one kingdom. That's how it works. And then when we ask ourselves, why love? Come back to the beginning over here. The Rambam's notion that everything is being held together by God's plan. It is by God's plan, facilitated by people who care enough for the greater good. If you look at the difference between Europe and America, just, you know, on a holistic perspective, Europe is numerous states, and each state has its own interests and currency and language and wars. And there's not been a decade without a war in all of Europe. And you look at the United States of America, just as a different example, you have now 50 states plus and growing with one federal government. Meaning to say, how is it possible to be able to have not just a bunch of fiefdoms, but a kingdom, one federal government? That's what was being achieved over here because of self-sacrifice. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful night.